All right, everyone, Ed Gandia here, and welcome to the second coaching call for the Warm Email Prospecting Program. Great to have you here. We got some really good questions for this round. A couple of announcements before we get to your questions. The first is just a reminder that all of you guys get an email evaluation from me, one of your sample email scripts. And you have till the end of the year to submit that, so you got plenty of time. But feel free to send them anytime. Instructions for how to do that and what to include in your script are in the program itself under the bonuses section. When you mouse over the bonuses, you'll see one of the options is the email evaluations. Click there, and I detail all that information for you. So make sure to do that. Again, no big hurry, but don't forget. The other thing is not so much an announcement, but, you know, really something I've been thinking about over the last few weeks and after the call from last month. I just wanted to make sure that, you guys start taking action. So I know a lot of you have. I've gotten great feedback from many of you. You're already putting into practice the material and getting results. You're getting leads. A couple of you have gotten clients, which is great. But, don't overthink it. Don't try to get it to a perfect state before you start trying this strategy. You know, the great thing about warm email prospecting is, it doesn't have to be perfect the first time around. And that's why, in one of the lessons I talked about B-level scripts. You know, you don't have to have an A-level script every time. And you can start with B-level scripts. That's fine. Just get started. There's just a magic happens when you just start taking action, even if it's not perfect. You start getting more practice. You start seeing what's going to work for you. You start getting some feedback. You get more comfortable with writing these. You get better. And if you just wait until the stars align, it's just that they never will. So, again, just make action, taking action, your number one goal. Doesn't have to be perfect. Just go out there with what you got and start somewhere. All right. So one last thing. Just keep in mind that this is being recorded. I have all your questions already. If there's time, I might open it up for some questions at the end. And the most practical way of doing that, just because I'm here by myself today, Crystal's out until Monday, is to, for those of you on the webcast, that's going to be the best way. If there's time, if I open it up for questions, if you're on the webcast, there's a box where you can type in your questions. I'll give you instructions at that point to cue you for that, but don't know if we'll have time. But just keep in mind the call is being recorded, so if you miss any part of this or if you want to listen to it again, it's going to be available immediately. And again, that's also going to be in the bonuses area of the program. The coaching calls are all there together. Just click on the link there and you'll be able to, it'll take you to Instant Tell Seminar. And from there, it'll walk you through it. It's very self-explanatory. You'll be able to get right to the replay. You can either play it there on the player or you can download the MP3 file, upload it to your iPod or listen to it on your computer. All right. So with that out of the way, let me just jump right into the first question I have. And these are in no particular order. The first question is from Giselle. She wanted to know, when sending email, is it okay to send it to the CEO and then CC or carbon copy the marketing manager? Well, here's what I would actually ask you, Giselle, is you need to decide or you need to know who's typically the person who would make a hiring decision for the services you're providing. If it's the CEO, then go to them. If it's the marketing manager or marketing director, then I would go to them instead. So it's really not so much about trying to cover all these different people and just trying to hedge your bets by emailing 2, 3, 4, 5 people. It's really more about who's the best person to approach about this. I think with email, it's better to just go to one person and go to the one where you think you have the highest chances of getting some kind of response, rather than trying to send it to several people. I'm not a big fan of CCing others, either when doing sales letters or when doing emails. I think it sends the wrong message. It basically tells the person you're sending the email to that, hey, I'm copying your boss, so if you don't respond, you know, I can then show them that you just don't respond to your emails. You're not saying that, but I think that's what it communicates in many cases. That's how a lot of people perceive it. So I would avoid that. You know, there's back years ago when I was actually writing my own sales letters for my sales jobs just to get leads in the door, I read a ton of books on writing sales letters and different approaches. One book in particular actually talked about that strategy. It was called The Power to Get In, and this guy's strategy was all about sending the sales letter to like five or six people in the organization, and then you'd copy all the others. So then you would show every person who got the letter who else received a copy of that. And then you would play them against each other in a way by just using leverage and saying, hey, you know, I'm also copying everybody else and your boss on this message, so, you know, you need to respond. And, you know, I did it. I tried it. It worked a couple of times, but it always felt a little bit too gimmicky for me, a little bit, I don't know, it just didn't sit well with me. So, anyway, that's just me with a CC. I just think sending the message to one person. Now, another thing you can do if you're not really sure, or if it really depends, and you, I think both of them could work for you, then send it to both of them, but then address them both in your salutation. So don't CC anybody. If it's Robert and Jennifer, send it to Robert and Jennifer, and then in the salutation say, hi, Robert, and hi, Jennifer, or dear Robert and Jennifer. And then go on from there. All right. Hang on just one second, guys. Let me switch my headset because I'm getting a little bit of static on my end, and I want to make sure I get a good quality recording from this. All right. Sorry about that. I'm back. All right, so number two, this is also from Giselle. She wanted to know, can I send an email that offers some type of work or service, for example, branding style guide? And if I don't get a response within 3 months, at that time send another email offering another kind of service, for example, a new collection catalog service. How can I reach again later prospects who didn't respond the first time? Good question. You know, the reason for suggesting a service to the prospects really needs to make sense, and it needs to be tied to the meaningful connection that you're making. So there needs to be some congruency here. You know, it can't come across as you're trying to push this branding guide or this branding service, and you're trying to make it fit into something. And then so you have this trigger event, and then you kind of sneak in this branding service suggestion, but you're not tying it to the trigger event or the meaningful connection. It just feels disjointed in a way. It doesn't feel right. It just feels, here again, gimmicky. So, you know, let me give you an example. This is just something I just thought of right now. Let's say you're approaching a small microbrewery. And, you know, let's say that you're approaching them because you read about them in an article where the president of that microbrewery was interviewed about the microbrew industry in Portland, Oregon, for example. Well, if that's going to be the meaningful connection you're going to use, hey, I saw your article, your president was being interviewed about this, you can't then launch into this. You know, by the way, I got this branding service that I do. I think you'd be a great candidate for this. I think it could really help you. You need a bridge. It's not flowing right. It feels, again, like you're trying to make it fit. So maybe what you could do, instead of using the article, you could still use the article as a trigger event. You could say, hey, it's great. I was reading about this. You know, I'm a big microbrew connoisseur. And you could then say, hey, by the way, I'm also writing because I've worked with two other microbreweries to help them rebrand, and you know, I thought I might be able to help you if you have, you know, a need for this type of work now or in the future. Would it make sense for us to connect? So I think that approach, see, makes a lot more sense. You're still using the article as the trigger event, as the meaningful connection. But now you're bringing in the fact that, okay, why is this relevant? Why them? Why your service? Because, you know, I've worked with similar companies to help them with X. And then now you've tied it in nicely and wrapped it up and put a bow on it. So, you know, the bottom line is I don't think you're going to get great results. Again, if you just you have a couple of things you're trying to push and you're just trying to make them fit. And, you know, you're trying to create a marketing sequence like you described above where, okay, well, I'm going to pitch them the marketing or the branding thing first, and if 3 months later if I don't hear from them, I'll pitch them the catalog service. You know, that's more of a traditional email marketing flavor, where warm email prospecting is much more organic, much more personalized and authentic. So I hope that makes sense. You know, it's just a very different approach, where instead of you having an agenda, what you're doing is you're seeing the needs and what's happening in the market. You know, you're talking to friends, you're talking to colleagues, and you see opportunities. And then based on the opportunities, then you're trying to figure out, okay, how could I approach that person or that prospect with something that would make sense? See, it's you're working backwards, in other words. Instead of this is what I want to push, who can I push it to? All right, this next question is from Claudia, and she asks, in one of your modules, you talk about copying and pasting a URL link into the warm prospecting email. That URL would take the reader directly to an article or some document you want the prospect to read. My question is a multi-part question. I have a website that I deliberately use as an electronic brochure. I'm wondering when it would be good to attach a link to my website in a warm prospecting email. I was also thinking of adding another page to my website that would contain articles I've written. If you don't think it's a good idea to use a link to my website in the first email, then how would I include something I have written in a warm prospecting email? Where would that URL that you mentioned go to? A blog, an article, website, or what? What's your advice on all this? Good question. So what I talked about, and this is in a few of the examples, in the program, is including a link to an article, a blog post, a case study, or other document. Those are just examples of soft offers that you could include in your email. And instead of including an attachment, you know, it'd just be better to say, hey, and by the way, you can read more about what I've done with this here, or how I've helped, you know, similar companies here, or about this particular service and how it might help you here. It's just easier, more convenient, and less threatening to include a link to that piece than it would be to include an attachment. So the idea with that is just to show the prospect how you've helped other clients with a similar challenge, or maybe, again, a one sheet that explains what you do and how you add value, something along those lines. But it's got to make sense. It's got to be, again, kind of like what I was suggesting to Giselle, it's got to be congruent. There's got to be a natural flow from the meaningful connection to what you're suggesting via your article. The article could be proof. It could be a credibility element that you know what you're doing, that you've produced results or that you know this topic or this area well. It can also be a sample or a page with various samples of your work that would be relevant to this prospect. In terms of, you know, should you use a link in your first email, there's really no rule that says you shouldn't include a link in your first email. I think the bigger question is what you should include. And that really depends on what you have available and, again, what would be relevant to that prospect. And it's got to flow. It's got to make sense within the context of the email. So, you know, it sounds like you have a nice library of articles that you've written. And what I would do is I would look through them, and based on the meaningful connection that I'm making, based on the prospect that I'm reaching out to, I'd pick an article that makes the most sense. And include a link to that. Now, the important thing is that that URL you're including there should take the prospect straight to that article. So a big mistake some people make is they just send them to their homepage and say, okay, so go to my homepage and then look under articles and then go to archives and then look for the one from October 2011. Nobody's going to go through the trouble of doing that. So make it super easy by including a direct link to the page for that article or for that document or that sample or whatever it might be. All right, Claudia's second question was, my business email is, and I'm not going to give you her email, but basically her URL, her domain name is hyphenated. And she is concerned because she heard somewhere or read somewhere that hyphenated emails or domain names are more apt to end up in spam filters than unhyphenated emails. Do you know that's true? All right, so I've never heard of that before. When I got your question, I did a little bit of research on this, and the answer was actually kind of technical. And I'm not sure I fully understood the meaning behind it or what's going on or all the details, but here's what I gathered, okay? Apparently, there are a lot of spammers who are tricking spam filters by using special characters, or called shy characters, that fool the spam filter. So, for example, spam filters know that if you're somebody's sending an email or to you, okay, let me back up. If the email being sent is coming from at UPS.com, a spam filter is going to know that that's very likely a legitimate email. What I gathered from the research that I did is that some of these spammers are using these special characters. They can't get the at UPS.com, but they can get at UPS, and then it's like a hyphen that's hidden, S.com, UP-S.com, something along those lines. The spam filter doesn't see the hyphen. It just sees UPS.com. So does the reader, the recipient. And that's where the problem lies, and that's where spam filters apparently are having some difficulty. Now, it doesn't appear to be the case with real hyphenated emails, meaning domain names that are hyphenated like yours, where it's there's basically a hyphen in the middle of your domain name. I think that's fine. I couldn't find any information that said that. I really wouldn't worry about it. I think the bigger question is this. Are you finding that a lot of people don't get your emails? And I'm not talking about prospects. I'm not talking about warm emails. I'm talking about just general emails. Sounds like you've had this email address for a while. When you're emailing clients, colleagues, friends, family, using this email address, do you find that a lot of people don't get your stuff? You say, well, I never got it. If they don't, then there might be a problem somewhere in there. I'm not sure if it has to do with a hyphen. It might be other factors, but that's when I would start worrying and start researching this further. If not, if that's not an issue, your prospects are not going to have an issue. They're still going to get the email in most cases, so I wouldn't worry too much. All right, this next question is from Janet. She asks, how fresh does a trigger event need to be? I've been doing a lot of online research into some of my niche prospects, and I've come across a lot of articles, press releases, etc., but most are from, say, last summer. I'm getting on lists to be contacted for future ones, but I'm wondering if it's a bad idea to contact someone regarding one of these older events. And to be honest, that I just ran across it online and want to congratulate them or inquire about the process or whatever, depending upon the event. Yeah, trigger events, Janet, definitely have a shelf life. And in most cases, 1 year is just going to be too long. There's no hard and fast rule. It really depends on what the event is. In some cases, you know, just even a week or two later is too late. In some cases, you're okay 2-3 months later. But 1 year, in most cases, it's just going to be too long. It's just not going to be relevant anymore, and it's not going to come across as authentic. What I would do instead is just be on the lookout for future events now that you have – sounds like you have some alerts set up. And I would also explore other ways of making those meaningful connections. So I wouldn't just rely – and this is something I want to make sure everyone understands. I want everyone to realize that – these trigger events are not going to be the only way to make that meaningful connection. I talked about two others, which is leveraging a mutual connection. There's many ways to do that, which I discuss in the program, or mentioning something impressive about yourself, your services, your clients, your track record, some accomplishment, anything along those lines. Now, that really opens it up. There's a lot of things you could do there. And it's hard for me to give you a laundry list of those because it all depends on your profession, what you do, what services you offer, and it also depends on what makes sense for different situations. And most of this is really going to come from some creative brainstorming, and as you come across opportunities and you hear about events and you hear rumors or word gets around about something, you'll think of these things that you could leverage. But I don't want people to think that, you know, you have to be on the look, you have to read the Business Chronicle every day or every week, and that's where everything's going to come from. Not true. In fact, many of you I know don't target prospects that get media coverage. So if that's all you're doing, you're really limiting the potential connections that you could make. So if it doesn't make sense for your industry, your target market, if they're not really going to be, you know, in the news, if they're not going to be quoted in, you know, trade journals, that sort of thing, then, you know, find other ways. There's many, many different ways, and I talk about those in the program. Just make sure that they're not too old and see how else you can make that connection. Now, Janet also had another question. She said, are upcoming national or regional trade shows a good trigger event to offer my services? My reluctance is that everyone in my industry tends to come to these, so I would have to craft it carefully to not appear as a blanket email or spam. It can't be something like, are you prepared for AWWA, ACE in Dallas in June? That type of subject line. It will take some research to see what they may be promoting or presenting on, for instance, but I believe I can find this information. And you're right, Janet. So the events themselves are typically not going to be good trigger events because everyone's going to be marketing at them. Everyone's trying to use that angle. Even if you have a very personalized subject line and message, it's just going to be hard to stand out from the pile of emails that they're getting in promotional items about the show. I think for you, and I looked at what you do, and I actually used to be in that business, the waterworks industry. For you, new product introductions are going to be more relevant. So are new industry regulations, new trends, new technologies, that sort of thing. I would be focusing more on that than on the trade show as an excuse to contact them. So you're right. You know, the email can quickly take more of a mass email feel, and it's going to be ineffective. So I would try to avoid this. Now, I'm going to come back to this because I think later you asked another question related to this, and it actually changes my answer, but I don't want to answer it here. I have your other question further down, and I will make sure to come back to this. All right, another question. I believe this is also Janet. Would offering a reduced rate for some work now – say in preparation for the above-mentioned trade show, be a bad idea? I'm just getting started and have some leads for work, but it's we'll talk in 3 months kind of stuff. I listened to your teleseminar on getting work from existing clients and like those ideas, but you need existing clients to implement most of those. That's true. So in terms of should you offer a reduced rate for in order to do a project now, is that a good incentive? Is that something that's going to get someone's attention? Possibly. I'm a big believer in offering these kind of arrangements when you're starting out or when you're looking to introduce a new service and you need some samples and some real experience. So you could really make it work there, and it's a great way to get those samples quickly and get started quickly and get that experience. The problem is that in a warm email, it's a bit risky. So here's what I wouldn't do. I wouldn't do like a percentage off offer. So like, you know, I'll do your next, you know, white paper for 50% off. And that's not going to work very well because it's not going to mean anything to the prospect. They don't know how much a white paper is. They don't know how much you charge for this. So, you know, 50% off of what? I think a dollar amount makes a lot more sense. It almost has to be kind of, in this case, kind of a flat fee offer. Say, hey, for the next 2 weeks or a month, next 30 days, I'm doing, I could do a white paper for $750. It's 5 to 7 page, you know, you scope it out, 5 to 7 page business white paper for $750, and then say that's 75% off my standard fee. So then that way you put it in context. Okay, well, $750, they may not know, is that good, bad? And now you're letting them know. Now, the other risk that you take when you do this in a warm email is you haven't really built trust with them yet. So, you know, you got 100, 125 words to get this across, to get them to see who you are, what you do, why you're different, why you're better, and then you have to also now make this offer. And what may happen is that, you know, they may not just be interested in getting a great deal. They may feel that such a low ball offer is, you know, maybe you're not that experienced, or they're going to be worried, well, why is she doing it so cheaply? And, you know, yeah, they want a great deal, but they want it done right. So you don't know. What are they motivated by? Yes, they're motivated by saving a few bucks, but, you know, they might also the low ball offer could come across, could raise red flags, I guess, is really the biggest concern I would have. So, you know, what I've found is these types of offers, especially in a warm email, tend to work best when you already know the person or you've been introduced through a mutual friend or a colleague. Because, you know, in that case, you can be completely transparent. Just let them know, hey, so look, I'm an experienced writer. I'm extremely knowledgeable in this industry, but I'm trying to get some samples under my belt. And I am offering to do 3 white papers for 3 separate clients for a drastically reduced fee, you know, specifically $750, in exchange for the ability to use it as a sample. And if you really like it, it's just a brief testimonial, that sort of thing. That's just easier to do in a much more transparent and convincing way. If you've been introduced, if you have a mutual connection, that sort of thing, than it would be in a just a email out of the blue, you know, traditional warm email. All right, moving on. Next question from Linda. One of the things I do is to offer communications training programs to entrepreneurs. I am trying to fill my class sessions, so I have used the constant contact approach to announce the events. I do also use a targeted email marketing approach to a few key prospects or customers, but want to reach a broader audience. How does the email marketing approach work in this scenario? Now, Linda, I'm assuming you're asking, how does the warm email prospecting approach, the more personalized individual approach, work when you're trying to fill seats in a program or trying to sell a particular program instead of kind of a traditional freelance service, for example? And the answer is it can work really well. And I agree with you. You need to supplement this with a standard broadcast email effort using a tool like Constant Contact, for example, because that's going to be the best bet. That's where you're going to fill the most seats, is really sending out a broadcast to your list of prospects and clients about this upcoming training seminar you're doing. But when you reach out to specific individuals based on what you've heard about them, you've read about them, you know about them or know about their companies and what they're doing, that can be extremely effective. You'll find that the response rate on those sort of emails are much higher. And again, keep in mind that in this type of email, unlike with maybe your constant contact broadcast email, if you use warm email prospecting to maybe fill some of these seats, your goal with this warm email is not to get a registration from that email. You're not including the button to register. Your goal is just to get a response, to get a reply to that email. So you can now schedule a brief call. And then at that point, during the conversation, you can see if your training program would work for that prospect, if it makes sense. You can address questions, that sort of thing. So, again, I've talked about this before. You're tossing the ball to them. You want to know they'll toss it back. That's all you're trying to do. So it's a different approach, different expectations. And this real selling is not going to be done in that first email. That's just there to pique interest. The real selling is done in the following email and in the phone conversation that hopefully you'll have with some of these folks. But I think it's a great idea, and I'm glad you're thinking out of the box. It sounds like you know you can fill a lot of these seats through traditional methods, but you'd like to try something different to maybe fill the rest with some prospects you feel require a more personalized one-on-one approach, and I would definitely try that. Okay, next question is from James, and he asks, all my clients are basically 1 to 5 person small businesses. For example, my current clients are a UFC fighter who owns his own training facility. He says he's doing a flyer for him and a press release. Another one is a hearing aid company / store that just started in July, so budget is tight. And he started with a press release that he wrote for them, and he plans to develop their newsletter, which is very basic at this point. And this is a second hearing aid client. I bought the course because I'm trying to move up in the types of clients I get. The value statement doesn't seem like something I would do right now, and the ideal client worksheets are the clients that I'd like to get eventually, not what I have worked with so far. So I would be adjusting the answers accordingly. And by the way, I agree with that last part. So look ahead, not where you are today. Then he continues, I'm sure that Ed has a number of people in the program who are at the stages that I am. I have clients more like mom-and-pop stores than a medium-sized business of 100 or more people. I've taken a course on writing autoresponders. I've taken one on writing white papers. So I want to target my emails to get those types of B2B, business-to-business clients. Any tips on how I should work through the program with that in mind? You bet. This is definitely a great way to build and grow your business. In fact, that's how I got started. A lot of people don't know this, but okay, so today I write content and lead generating campaigns and copy for software companies, and typically software companies that have really expensive software systems, $1 million plus systems. But my first client, and many clients during my first year, were not software companies. They were very small companies. And my first actual client was a potato chip company. And they wanted me to write, they hired me to write package copy, which is basically, you know, a bag of potato chips or a box of crackers. There's some copy in the back that describes the product. And in their case, which it was something like, you know, 100 words or 50 words, something like that. It was very brief. And I had done a direct mail campaign. They were one of the few who responded. And, you know, I think I was doing these for like $300 a pop. Could knock them out in an hour or two, which is great. But, you know, I'd get a couple of these a month. I mean, obviously I can't live off of that. And, you know, for someone who's trying to then go into software, not necessarily your most glamorous client. Now, a few days or within a week or two of that, I actually landed my first software client. That's who I consider to be my first real client. But really before them, the first paying client I had was a potato chip company. And I just built from that because, you know, that first software client that I just mentioned, they weren't that big. They were a small software company. Really tight budget, very lean staff, not a well-known name at all. So here's what I would suggest. There's nothing wrong with starting this way. The key to making this work is to stair-step your success and your efforts. So what you do is you use your successes with these initial clients, right, the boxer, the hearing aid clients, and you use them to get to the next level of client. And maybe the next level of client is a a 10-person or 20-person packaging supplies manufacturer. Okay, so it's still not ideal, let's say, but it's bigger. They have a little bit more money to spend. They can give you more projects, that sort of thing. And then you use this next client to get to the next level of client and so on. In other words, you don't go from mom-and-pop hearing aid company with three people and staff to IBM. You're not going to do that overnight, okay? So you work your way up there. But the key thing is you keep moving. Don't get stuck at any one level for very long. So, you know, I could have gone with a potato chip company and then approach other food and beverage manufacturers and, you know, try to then leverage that success. But I said, you know what, I'm not going to go in that direction. I could. That's not where I want to go eventually. So I'm just going to use the success to get to the next one. I actually used some of those samples, even though they were not software related. But I just wanted to show people that I can write all kinds of copy. And at that point, I had three or four different samples. None of them were software, but you know, I could show what I did, and it worked. All you need for the next level is for someone to give you a chance. Someone who, okay, so these samples aren't extremely relevant to what I do, but I see where this guy or gal is going. I can see the talent. I can see that, you know, they can write well. I think I could benefit. I'm willing to take a chance on them. Just need someone to give you a chance. And then you work for them. You get better samples. You get a little bit of a track record, and now you can get to the next level. So don't think that you have to start big. I think you're doing it just right. Now, I disagree with something you said. You said that it's not worth crafting your value statement right now because it just, you know, because of where you're working with right now. But you know what? I think you always need a value statement, even if it's very basic and maybe wouldn't impress the kind of client you eventually want to be working for. You still need one so you can still talk about what you do now and talk about that to that next level of client. It doesn't have to be anything super impressive. Just, you know, talk about how you help these businesses, what you do, and what makes you a bit different. So maybe it's the fact that you help mom-and-pop businesses produce high-end copy and messages that would normally cost a fortune to create if they went to a marketing firm or an ad agency. You do it for a fraction of the cost. Or maybe you can say something similar, maybe that you help them communicate their value clearly at an ad agency level, but without the price tag. Something along, I mean, these are just really raw ideas. But even at this level, you can create some sort of value statement that will resonate with these types of clients. Now, obviously, your value statement will need to evolve as you stair-step your way to better quality clients. But start where you are and then just focus on doing an incredible job for these clients. Know that there's a brighter future out there, and that future depends on delighting these current clients so that you can get better, get great testimonials, and then prepare yourself for the next level of clients. So never, you know, dwell on your current situation and say, well, this sucks, you know, I'm stuck here forever. Not true. Do it with a smile, do the best job possible, and know where you're heading, and keep your eye on the prize. You know, you'll be fine. Good question. All right, so moving on. Giselle has a question. All right, so she had said, this is a follow-up to a question she had on the first coaching call. Back then, you had told me to improve my value statement, so I made some changes, and I'd like your opinion, see if it's better now or how I can improve it further. All right, so it's, and I believe it's pronounced Papel Design Studio, Creative Solutions for Your Business Challenges. So that sounds like the tagline. And here is a value statement. Are you sick of identity programs and PowerPoint presentations that you're embarrassed about? Are you frustrated that your website and marketing materials don't speak the same language? Are you ready for a more attractive and profitable image? Papel Design is a strategy design studio focused on growth. will help businesses like yours who are hungry for growth rebrand your corporate image and reinvent business, providing strategic differentiation to the marketing to finally attract more customers and increase sales. All right, so let's go back to the value statement formula that I talked about in the first module, which is it really needs to identify what you do, for whom, why you're different, what relevant value you bring to the table, or whom you've worked for that's worth mentioning. Now, you have a combination of these items here, some of these items, but to me, this reads more like an ad. So I wouldn't start with these leading questions because that's really not part of your value statement. That would be maybe copy you'd use in an ad or, you know, an email broadcast or something along those lines or a brochure. Your value statement basically starts by, again, explaining what you do, which you started doing about two-thirds of the way down when you said we help businesses like yours who are hungry for growth rebrand your corporate image. So I think that first part is okay, but after that, I think you have a lot of filler words in there that might sound good to you and me, but they're not going to mean a whole lot to your prospect. They're just too vague. They're too overused. In specific, I'm talking about reinvent their businesses, providing strategic differentiation for the marketing to finally attract more customers and increase sales. So a couple things, a little vague, a lot of filler words, and it just doesn't seem believable to me. I think if you're going to talk about increased sales and those sorts of things, you almost need to bring in an example. For example, we worked with, ABC Beverage recently to increase leads by 27% or increase sales by 32% over an 18-month period. I don't know, something along those lines, because you really kind of need to prove that point because it just seems a little far-fetched. Here's what I'd urge you to do, and I think this might help. I would set this aside and then just run through this exercise. So think of your two or three favorite clients of all time, and hopefully – try to think some that have been fairly recent, let's say within the last 2 or 3 years. Your two to three absolute favorite clients. They were just a joy to work with. They were profitable. They had plenty of work for you, whatever those qualifiers might mean to you. And then just ask yourself, okay, what did you like about them? What made them special? Why do they appreciate you and your expertise? Why do they hire you? Why do they continue to use your services if they use you for more than one? And if you don't know, ask them. Call them up or send them an email. I think an email would be better. But just a very simple question. Hey, what would you say is my unique capability? What did you like best about working with me? So ask that of your two or three favorite clients. And see if you see any patterns there from their, when it comes to their responses. So that's their responses. But also then you need to ask yourself, okay, what was it about them that I loved? And then use as much of that information to craft that statement. The other thing I would do is to maybe focus more, on the clients that I've worked with in the statement and leverage those names and some of those samples a little bit more. So, I just think when you're in a very competitive situation or a profession, when there's a million other competitors out there, and specifically I'm talking about copywriting, branding, web design, there's a lot of people that do this. So it's really what you've done for your clients that really sets you apart. That's the differentiator. It's your expertise or track record in one or two or three target niches, those sorts of things. And so that value statement, if you take that approach, is going to vary depending on who you're approaching. So if you're approaching a food and beverage manufacturer, your value statement may be more customized to mention a couple of names of companies you've worked with in that industry. If it's a certain type of service you offer, a certain type of challenge or result you deliver – then you would focus on that. But it's really, you know, again, at the end of the day, if it's a very competitive Me Too type of industry or profession, you really need to leverage those stories, those successes, that track record. I know this doesn't happen overnight. Some of you are starting out, but that's what you build towards. Okay, so this is why when I was talking earlier to the other gentleman about stair-stepping your way to success, okay, use the results that you've gotten, the client names that you've worked with. They don't have to be big names, but you're showing that you've worked, you have a track record maybe in this industry, or you have a track record with just, you know, clients in general, or doing this, or, you know, producing these white papers that really help describe their products and services much more efficiently in a much more compelling way, and it shortens the sales cycle, you know, and now, you know, hopefully maybe you can even get some metrics around that. So for this client I worked with and we wrote this piece, you know, we were able to measure that their average sales cycle went from 6 weeks to 3.5 weeks, you know, that sort of thing. So anyway, go through that exercise, and I'm willing to bet, and it sounds like you've done some work for some great companies out there. Again, they don't have to be household names. Leverage those successes instead of trying to talk about growth and, you know, the providing strategic differentiation to the market to finally attract more customers and increase sales. It's just not really communicate that much to a prospect. All right. Got a question here from Janet. All right. She says in one of the sessions about using contacts, Ed says to use sales reps last, dead last. I'm concerned about this is because this is the primary contacts that I have. In my niche, the water and wastewater equipment industry, the equipment manufacturers are represented by businesses that may represent dozens of equipment manufacturers. These equipment vendors work with local engineers and try to get their equipment matched up with projects. They may bundle several pieces of equipment for a project that is coming out for bid. I know a lot of these equipment reps, and they are my basic contacts to the manufacturers. So they're the connections to the manufacturers. One of them has also been working with me to get me in with their major equipment manufacturer, one of the major players that has several lines of equipment. My question is, why are sales reps the least promising of the contacts to use to gain access to marketing staff? And what is the best way to approach and leverage these contacts if these are all you have? All right, so let me clarify, because sales reps are not necessarily the last resort. I'd say that in many industries they are, Janet, but in your case, that's an exception, definitely an exception. It's a different model over there. So just so everyone kind of understands, because, again, this is an industry I'm very familiar with. The manufacturers themselves don't do much of the marketing. So they hire these companies that will go out and do all the shoe leather. They have the feet on the street, and they're the ones peddling this stuff, trying to get it spec'd or specified in projects so that whoever lands that project, whatever contractor gets selected to install this equipment, they are forced to use this manufacturer's equipment. That's basically the strategy. But again, that work is not done by the manufacturer. They're done by a rep agency that they hire to do this. It's the way it's been done for years, kind of an old-fashioned approach, but it's an old-fashioned industry. That's just the way it is. And it sounds like, Janet, most of her contacts are for the sales reps in these manufacturer representative firms that do the peddling. So here's what I would do, Janet. I think that is an absolute awesome contact, and I would leverage the heck out of them. The first thing I thought of was this. So think about what they want, what these sales reps want. So what if you could say in an email that you could help them make their jobs a lot easier if they had a white paper, for example, that better explained this new product and its advantages over the old method? All right, so think about it. This guy or gal, they have tons of other products they have to rep. And if they have better tools to sell certain ones, great, sort of like a great leave behind case study or white paper that is well researched, it's well documented, it just flows well, it's just, it really explains the product in a way that an engineer could understand and makes a very compelling case for it, then you're going to make it easier for this rep to get that product spec'd into these projects. So always start by thinking, okay, what's in it for them? How can I approach them in a way that's going to show immediate benefit and not like they're doing me a favor? You know, this is a mutually beneficial situation. So that would be my angle. It's the first one I thought of. There might be others. All right. Janet's second question is about using trade shows as the event. So this is tied to her original question from earlier in the call about trade shows, but now she asks a very different question here about these trade shows. She says that she has a major trade show coming up where in South Carolina where she's located, and she'd like to know how to approach the manufacturers and reps that are exhibiting at this trade show. Again, most of the exhibitors are the sales rep businesses who may be representing several of the manufacturers. What are the best ways to email these folks, and should I work through the actual exhibitors, the reps in other words, or should I try to identify the manufacturers that they'll be representing and contacting the manufacturers themselves? Is a trade show a good trigger event? We have a few very large national trade shows in my niche, and I would like to leverage these into good client contacts. Is this a reasonable trigger event for getting in touch? Absolutely. So now that you give me this information, I'm going to actually somewhat change my answer from earlier. I think in this case, we're talking a very different animal here, because now the people who are going to be there are going to be the like your best contacts, your entry into these manufacturers. So again, I would use the approach that, or I would consider using the approach I just suggested. Look at what they rep and identify maybe one or two products or manufacturers that have a very promising product, for example, but it's not being marketed well or explained well. And maybe suggest, you can only do this with a couple, right? You're not going to be able to do this with 10 different products. Maybe, you know, come to them with a clear suggestion. Hey, you know, here's a great example. This product, you know, it's obviously fantastic. It's been proven to do this, that, and the other. So much better than the alternatives and, you know, the way it's been done for 30 years. But look how they're marketing it. You know, they got this two-page brochure, and that's it. So you have to do the heavy lifting. You're the one who has to do all that selling. What if I could give you something, you know, do a really good job helping you sell this thing? So that's the approach I would take. And basically it's all about showing them how you can make his job easier and then see if he can make that introduction for you into the manufacturer, because they'd be the ones who would probably be making the buying decision or the hiring decision. All right, so those are all the questions we received for this round. We have about 5 minutes, though, so we have time for some questions if anyone has some. And just so you know, again, it's the easiest way is going to be to, if you're on the webcast, you'll see the box where you can ask questions. Just type in your question there. I will see it. I will read it out loud, and I will answer it. So not sure there's going to be any, but I did want to go ahead and use the time we had if anyone had anything out there lingering. All right, so let's see. No questions so far. I'm going to give it another minute. While I'm waiting, there's something else I wanted to mention. Some of the scripts that have come in that I've evaluated. There's a temptation to kind of give a lot of information in the email, in this initial warm email. And I totally get that. I mean, I tend to fall into that as well. But it's really, really important that you try to keep it under 125 words. whenever possible. In most cases, you can do that without the message suffering, without it losing its effect. Every word has to count, obviously, but try not to give them too much in that email. It should kind of seem like too much work. Again, the idea of the email is not to sell everything. The idea is simply to get a reply. Just, hey, this sounds interesting. Possibly, you know, I might be willing to talk to you. And then to schedule that phone call or what have you. But all you want to know is, will they toss the ball back to you? And in many cases, you can do that in, you know, 100, 125 words tops. And that's really kind of the sweet spot. Beyond that, you really start losing people. All right, so one question here. So on the value statement, can I mention a client's name? Absolutely. Absolutely. So the last part of the value statement, so let me read the five items that it should include. And the last two are either or you can, it can be both. What you do, for whom, why you're different. And then number four, what relevant value you bring to the table. Or number five, whom you've worked for that's worth mentioning. Four or five, it could be either or. Well, you could have both. Just, you know, don't overdo it. But I think that so if you work in a profession like paid search, for example, many of you read my recent interview at the Academy with Corey Giacchino. He works in a very results-oriented field, paid search, very metric-driven, results-driven. It's all about the numbers. In his case, I would focus more on number four. What relevant value bring to the table? But if he's worked for some impressive clients, and in his case he has, I would also work on number five, whom you've worked for that's worth mentioning. And he's worked for IHC, Intercontinental Hotel, and some really impressive names. But if you don't work in a results-oriented field where things can be really measured, you know, it's design, photography, you know, so many others, right, that are softer fields, then really it's the clients you've worked for that where the big difference is going to come. All right, let me see if there's any others. All right, yeah, Janet, great. Glad to hear that was helpful. Let's see, June. Awesome. Yeah, I think you're absolutely on target by reaching out to those reps. In fact, I think you'll have really good success. I think those people are going to be easier to reach, and I think it's going to be easier to establish that meaningful connection than it would be kind of in a traditional scenario where you have, you know, kind of a corporate scenario where you have marketing managers that get flooded with email and it's really hard to stand out in that case. But in this case, I think you'll do well. I mean, and again, keep this in perspective, you know, meaning by when I say well, it doesn't mean you'll get an 80% success rate. Just mean instead of 3-5%, it could be, you know, over time, 15-20%, which is still outstanding. All right, let's see if there's any others. All right, one from Deb. Let's see. If you're contacting people you worked with but haven't seen in a while, can you just come right out and tell them you're looking for to expand your business? Should you email or phone them? Let's see. You've worked with them, but you haven't seen them in a while. You know, I would still... it's up to you. I mean, I like email initially, and in that case, maybe follow it up with a phone call because the email plants the seed, and if they don't reply, it doesn't matter. At least I've planted that seed. I might mention that I'm going to follow up with them in a few days over the phone, so they're expecting that. And then when I get my call, they're going to remember who I am because they just got a message from me, and they're going to remember probably why I'm calling. So I don't want it to be a total shock because I want them in a more receptive mood. And if they're trying to figure out who I am, it's going to be a little bit harder to be receptive. So I like using email and then following up with a phone call in this case. And, I would. I don't know if you listened to the teleseminar, the bonus teleseminar that we did a couple weeks ago, how to reach out to past clients and how to find kind of last-minute work. But I talk about that in there. The key is, you know, you really want to offer the justification. It can't just be about you. Yeah, I'm looking to expand my business. Do you need any help? You need to offer an idea. Hey, I notice you're doing more of this. You know, I'm looking to expand in that area. I'm starting to do some work there. I might be able to help you. That sort of thing. Instead of just coming across as, I have needs. I need you to help me. try. Again, the whole key of that bonus teleseminar was the fact that you want to offer justification. That makes all the difference in the world in your approach. Okay. All right, another question from Janet. The last module gave a very long launch emails. Is this an exception to the short 100 to 125 words because you know these folks, or is there another reason in play? Yeah, good question. All right, so a couple of things. The launch email technique was designed to reach out to good friends and good colleagues, people who know you well. Maybe it's been a while since you've talked. I just got an email from someone I used to work with years ago, and I haven't talked to him in 3 years. I just got an email from him yesterday. It was great to connect. You know, even though it's been 3 years, he's the kind of guy that I could feel comfortable reaching out to him anytime with kind of a longer email. It's that kind of relationship. So I'm not talking. He doesn't have to be my best buddy. He's not. He's a friend. He's a colleague. So that's the kind of audience that this longer format works with, versus, you know, the approach we've been talking about in the other modules, which is someone you don't know or who doesn't know you. In that, you have to be right to the point. Now, is it better to – shorter is always better, okay? So I will tell you I've gone over the years to a shorter format, even with the launch email technique. So when in doubt, shorter is better. And the reason it made it long, some of those were long, is that I was trying to explain. So these are friends, and I was trying to explain what I did in layman's terms. And that can take a little bit of room. And in many cases, that's what made the script so long. Could it be trimmed down? Absolutely. You know, I wrote those, and Steve and I wrote those a few years ago. I think all of us have moved into a shorter format. The basics are still there. They're timeless. But, you know, if we can kind of condense that a bit, go for it. But, you know, don't be afraid in that case to be a little longer. It doesn't have to be 125 words or less. Good question. All right. Let me see if there are any more. All right. Got one more here. I work for Fortune 500 companies, but I'm afraid to mention their names and scare the small clients. Yes, that is a risk. So if you're in, it doesn't work as well in reverse. It could turn them off. So in that case, you know, it all depends how you message it too, because if I'm going after small companies and I've done work for a couple of Fortune 500 companies, you know, you could always say, hey, I've worked for Citibank and Kaiser Permanente, but these days I focus on bringing that kind of quality work to smaller organizations who are on a shoestring budget. You know, that kind of message, I mean, there's different ways you could go with that, but that's just one example. Then it might work. But if you just use it as a standalone, you know, chest beating, I want to impress you type thing, it may actually scare them off. So good question, good point. It's all in how you position it. Just think about that and then make a decision. All right, guys. So great call. I hope this was helpful for you guys. I hope I answered everybody's questions. If for some reason, I don't think this is the case, but if for some reason you had sent a question before yesterday or earlier and I didn't answer it, it's because we didn't get it. So feel free to send it to me. This is not an invitation to send new questions. Just, you know, if you did honestly send it and I just didn't get to it, it's just because I didn't see it. So feel free to send it to ed@internationalfreelancersacademy.com. I know we had given another email address for the questions, but it's okay this time around for these questions. If any were missed, to send them to me directly, ed@internationalfreelancersacademy.com, and I will respond to you personally. Anyway, you guys, hope you have a great day, and go out there. Again, take action. Don't stall. Just keep out there. Keep refining. Keep trying new things. And let me know how you're doing. I'd love to hear from you. I'd love to hear what kind of results you're getting, if you're experimenting with different approaches, different ideas, things that are working, not working. Let us know. We always love to hear about what you're doing out there and what kind of results you're getting. So with that, have an awesome day, and we'll talk to you next time.
The moderator has left the conference.